One topic we've yet to dive into is what the role of specialty brands play in your portfolio and overall brand. There are so many decisions you can ponder when it comes to branding and marketing these beers. How elevated do you go? Do you want to be known as a brewery with elevated brands and higher price tags? How do you relate these labels to your core lineup and the branding of your brewery? I think the questions could go on. I've been following Andrew Emerton, the specialty brand manager for New Belgium Brewing, on Twitter. He's been active in the Twitter beer community and has been fun to follow. In this interview, we dig into the role that specialty brands play at New Belgium. What is the strategy in branding and marketing for the specialty beers they offer? What are the goals that New Belgium has around their specialty brands? Andrew's a smart dude with a history in the beer game. I hope you enjoy the conversation we had. Kick back and listen as Andrew Emerton speaks some brand knowledge on this episode of Branding Brews. This episode is coming out just before CBC 2019 in Denver, Colorado. Just want to drop the last reminder about the seminar that I'm doing for CBC called Brand Forward: Maximize Your Beer's Potential Through Design. We have a dynamic seminar with an amazing lineup of folks. We're showcasing a special artist series of beer labels that are for the CBC 2020 commemorative beers. We also have an expert panel that I will be moderating, talking all things beer label branding and design. Lastly, we want everyone there to stick around for a special social hour. If you are a creative in marketing or branding, stick around and help continue the conversation. We hope that everyone there can help spread some more good ideas and meet some new folks. Hope to see you in Denver. Now, on with the show. All right, welcome back everybody to another episode of Branding Brews. I'm your host, Ryan Wheaton, graphic design guy, I guess, maybe, for the beer market. And today I'm pretty stoked to be joined by Andrew Emerton, who is the specialty brand manager at New Belgium Brewing Company.
Yeah.
How's it going, man?
Great, man. Really stoked to be here. Awesome. I wish I was drinking a beer right now, but I definitely did just pour a coffee. So
yeah, even though it's 4 o'clock. Yeah, I'm drinking a chai right now. Right. So like, I feel like this comes up every time on this podcast. It's like every person I interview, they're just like, I wish I was having a beer right now.
Yeah.
So I don't know. Maybe I need to schedule this like in the evenings or something.
Yeah.
Yeah.
4 o'clock.
Well, sweet, man. Yeah. Can you give us a little background about like who you are and like how you got there?
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, so I have been with New Belgium for almost 10 years. It'll be 10 years, I think, next year. And I started out with us in sales, street level sales, in a position that we call Ranger, New Belgium Ranger, covering South Texas. I lived in Houston, spent most of my time in Houston as a beer ranger down there. Eventually moved up to Denver and was a rep there for a while, where I eventually started covering a lot more specialty sales. So focusing on our sour beer, I basically saw a bit of a gap or an opportunity there to where like the on-premise was continually pouring higher end beers and seemed to care more about that. And we didn't really have a system at the retail end of things to kind of peel back what was going on there, specifically with like restaurant groups, restaurateurs and such. So started working closely with Lauren here at the brewery. Lauren Limbach is her current name. She is our wood cellar director, and her and I started working pretty closely on event ideas and sour beer allocations and stuff like that. And then she was actually doing the specialty brand management side of things here at the brewery at the time while also running the wood cellar. So she that was obviously too much, a lot going on. So she was able to create like a specialty brand manager position, which allowed her to take on the wood cellar and for me to take on that role. Coincidentally, at that time, we got a new VP of marketing, and we had actually never really had brand management as a position within this brewery. That role was new, but then we got this VP of marketing who came in and kind of restructured the marketing department to have multiple brand management positions that all sort of operated in the same way. So now we have Fat Tire brand manager, we have Voodoo brand manager, we have Innovations brand manager, and then myself. So yeah, it's kind of a unique setup that we have going right now. Like I said, I've been here for 10 years. Before this, I was actually worked at a distributor in Denver, a Bud distributor there. Prior to that, I worked as a tour guide at the Budweiser Brewery here in Fort Collins while I was going to CSU. That's like way back when I was 22 or something like that, you know? So here I am, 15 years later, still doing the beer thing.
Yeah. Still in the game. Yeah. Well, cool. Yeah, man. So yeah, it sounds like you've got a pretty deep background. That's rad. Well, cool. So I was glad to have you come on. I think I try to cover unique topics on each episode and try to kind of take a deep dive into those. And I haven't really, I don't think, covered the idea of specialty beers in your portfolio, trying to release, the strategy behind it. Like, how do you, how do you fit that into your portfolio, especially for smaller to medium sized breweries? Do you come out with an entire line of specialties, or are they just something you sprinkle into all your normal releases? So,
It's tough. I wish there was a really easy, short answer to it all. And I mean, at the end of the day, there should be a relatively easy answer, and that should be your strategy of what you're trying to do, and ultimately, what your brewery strategy is. But our specialty strategy is to position New Belgium as the leading Belgian style brewer in the United States. So that was in itself, a pretty big undertaking to get to that point, to come back and say, yes, we make Belgian style beer. This is what we're going to focus on with the specialty portfolio. This is what we need. We want to send this message to our drinkers that we still care about these types of beers. It doesn't mean we have to make old world Belgian style beers all the time within this portfolio. We can do a lot of new innovative things, but it does give you a path to stay on, So prior to the revamping of our specialty lineup, we had a series of beers called Lips of Faith, which a lot of people fondly remember. Underneath that series was our sour program, but then also these kind of zany one-off releases of experimental ingredients and extreme styles and styles that people hadn't really heard of. And then we had this little side project thing going on called Hop Kitchen, and that was a lot of experimental hoppy releases. And so that was all kind of rolled into the quote specialty program. And that's when we decided it just wasn't, we were sending a lot of different messages with that, and that was also around the time that extreme, whatever you want to call it, crazy wonky ingredients and unique styles that wasn't all that new anymore. When Lips of Faith first started to come out and kind of hit its stride, that was still pretty unique. Dogfish was doing it, and there's a few others out there that were showing off some really experimental stuff, but then all of a sudden that really became the industry, So as soon as everybody else came on board and started doing a lot of things like that, as well as 22 ounce single serve bottles started to really die off, or that section became really crowded, it caused us to kind of pause and rethink what we're trying to do with the specialty portfolio. So that's what led us to, all right, we're a Belgian style brewer. We are coming out with we have these other, what we call purchase brands like Voodoo and Dayblazer and things like that. But the ambassador brand of New Belgium, that is Belgian style. That's Belgian style brewing. That's what's in our DNA. So we decided to take create a collection. We really looked at it almost like a clothes, like a fashion collection, So that was a big risk that we took when redesigning the specialty portfolio. And we wanted to create a range of pricing tiers, but also a similarity across all those, with little subtle cues that would denote that you are escalating in that series. So when I say the risk that we took is, using a lot of white, black, a little bit of red, and some gold across multiple brands. So Triple looks just like Abbey in the six packs, or just like 1554, for example. We're not giving other cues of color or ingredients or things like that. A lot of times color is a big cue for people when they're scanning a shelf. We're not doing that. And I would say that's a big risk on our end. It's rare that you see multiple brands have the same color palette, you know, but that's how we, again, that's kind of how we approached it with thinking of it more as like a fashion collection than looking at the rest of the industry for what to do. And I think that was a really unique approach, and it's really fun because it causes a good amount of disruption if it's merchandised correctly. You know, if we have our brands together, especially if we can get our single serve bottles next to our six packs, it gives people that really nice cue of like, okay, now you're premiumizing. So yeah. So with that, we took some existing brands like Abbey, 1554 and Triple, elevated them into a premium kind of a look and feel, which involved a different bottle mold, actually, which we're not currently running. We went back to our old bottle mold, but we installed a neck labeler. We have a different paper label on those bottles. We have a different six pack carrier, different die cut on that. We have different finishing touches on that. So the crown that goes on is different. It's black underneath it. We put a red flood underneath that crown on our bottles. A lot of work on the packaging range of things for that. And then we installed a cork and cage line, got rid of our 22 ounce lineup. That cork and cage line is able to do 375s and 750s, and they can do Belgian bottles or champagne style bottles or whole different. It opened up our options like crazy, especially with labels on that cork and cage line. Now we can run pressure sensitive, nicer, you know, wine stock labels on that. So it's a lot of work.
No kidding. Yeah, it sounds like it. Yeah. Cool. So I think you kind of touched on it, but like, so basically you're kind of thinking that, like, well, the role to a certain point of the specialty brands is to kind of like bring back the idea of like the Belgium from like,
yeah, that's Belgium. The, I mean, that's the strategy is really, remind people of our Belgian style brewing roots. You know, that's really what we were founded on. Our co-founder, Jeff, he's no longer our co-founder. He got out about five, six years ago now. But the whole brewery is kind of based on his trip to Belgium that he went on back in the 80s for a conference over there. And that's where he fell in love with Belgian style brewing. He was already a home brewer back here and came back here and started working on Fat Tire and Abbey, actually. Abbey was actually the very first beer. And he and his little homebrew club here started working on Belgian style beers when we first launched in 91. Throughout those 90s, I mean, the hoppiest beer we did was this little pale ale called Mighty Arrow up until 2010, maybe, I think it was 2009. Yeah, when we finally came out with Ranger IPA.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it was through and through. It's been our Belgian style roots. So in our portfolio now, we have. We have like Lawfully, obviously, in our Wood Age sour portfolio. Lawfully is the first ever commercial sour beer in the United States. Wood Age commercial sour. La Terroir, first ever dry hop sour. Transatlantic Creek, first international collaboration. Like, there's all kinds of firsts within our history because we've been kind of doing this Belgian style brewing thing for so long here. So we wanted to really remind people of that. But then at a more like tactical level, I guess you could say, the role of specialty is to really, you know, like some people view this range as like, you want people to, like you said in your notes, like people come into New Belgium at the core level and then like, quote, graduate up into more premium offerings as they become more sophisticated of a drinker. And I think that's true to some extent, but I actually don't think of it. I actually think of it in the opposite of that. So how I see the strategy of the specialty portfolio working is that these beers serve a purpose to to resonate with opinion leaders in this space, craft beer connoisseurs or people that just have an appreciation for more nuanced beers and are able to spend more on beers. They typically have are more culinary led minded people. So those opinion leaders, we need to keep them interested in our portfolio with by communicating some of our like legacy offerings like La Folie and La Terroir, but then also bringing them in with new super small batch, very experimental wood aged sours and other small batch Belgian style beers. And if we're able to pull that off and they have a really good experience with New Belgium at that point, and again, that's very important that New Belgium is part of that experience. It's high touch, you know, it's romanticized, that's all there, then they will advocate to their friends who look at them as the creative, you know, influencer of their group or whatever. And then those friends know that it's then safe to advocate for New Belgium to their friends. And then now you got core customers hearing word of mouth that New Belgium is a trusted brand, you know? So it's a reverse pyramid, you know, so you got to hit those. Or it's actually not a reverse pyramid. It's a real pyramid. You got to hit those. You got to hit that opinion leader over the head
a real pyramid,
pretty often with new news, good communication, good experiences, whatever it might be. And that's usually not in the form of paid or anything like that. That's more organic. It's more experiential. It's more in your breweries. And then on the flip side, that's when you have the inverse pyramid or the upside down pyramid. And that's when you're hitting your core customer with marketing that's usually down that paid route. And that takes a certain high level of frequency. It's also very expensive to do. This is sort of it goes hand in hand with that. So this is, they need to operate together, I guess is what I'm saying. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. That makes sense. Yeah. Okay. So that's interesting. I mean, cause yeah, I think like, as I kind of mentioned in my notes that like, that like a lot of times, like for spirits, it's common to have them, you know, like kind of have their baseline product and try to have, customers kind of graduate up that ladder to the higher tier products. So you kind of have like a two-prong approach, sounds like, right? So you're saying like, for the folks that are like, they're super into craft beer, they might be more kind of considered like influencers amongst their friends and like their community or whatever. Then if they're into your stuff, then they're going to be like advocates for your brand, basically.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. For sure. And it's more along the lines of thinking of like, I don't know that beer drinkers have the patience anymore to go on that journey. Like I know it still exists. I'm sure it still exists, but like, who's not I shouldn't say who's not a craft beer drinker. There's plenty of people that are not craft beer drinkers right now, but it's so noisy and chaotic out there that there's the idea of an entry point is not easy to assess when you're at the shelf.
You know, like it's gotta be all over the place.
Whereas it used to be pretty easy. It was, all right, here's your ambers, here's your wheats, here's, you know, a couple, here's your red ales and maybe an IPA or two. Like now that entry point is just way too cluttered. So it's hard to say that journey really exists anymore. And that's also the dangerous part of craft. You know, like if you don't know where to start, you're not going to start, you know? So that's when you're like, okay, I'll just get Truly or I'll get liquor, because these are powerful brands that aren't so cluttered, you know. So that's when we might have people leaving our set. So in that type of chaos, that's when we kind of have to take both approaches, I think. One of my favorite examples to point to, or I guess analogy to throw out there, is like, again, jumping over to that like fashion comparison, when you look at Adidas and what they did with Kanye West with Yeezys, that's very similar to that's a very similar tactic, I guess. So, you know, Kanye was with Nike for a long time. Adidas was able to get him on board with them, and they started coming out with Yeezys. And at the time, Nike was really running the game with sneakerheads, you know, and so they knew they needed to go after those sneakerheads. So they bring on Kanye, and he starts pumping out Yeezys in really, really small batches. You know, like, I can't remember the first release, but I think it was like 300 to 400 pairs or something like that. And since then, oh, they've wow. released like, yeah. I don't know, 40 or 50 different drops of Yeezys. And now sneakerheads are representing, are going after those and lining up to get those. And they're selling those in secondary markets and all sorts of stuff. But that sent a message to their friends who looked at them as like the creative influencers or whatever. And it made them feel safe to want or to wear Adidas. And then you see this, like, you see this ripple effect, or you see that halo effect take place. And whether it's for sure that did it, that's the hard part of marketing. It's always hard to point to one exact thing that you did that caused sales to increase. Oh, but sure. Year over year, they have had like double digit growth for like the past 3 or 4 years, you know, like since like signing on Kanye. They took a big hit that first year because nothing was happening with them. Then all of a sudden they came out the Yeezys and stuff just started turning around. So the theory, I think, is the same. You can apply that theory to just about any CPG out there. But I think craft beer has a lot in common with that, with the fashion industry, as far as like how fast paced it is. And
yeah.
And like we're entertainers, you know, like both industries are entertainers.
Yeah. And there's kind of like a cultural thing too. I mean, like, you know, like in that, if you support a certain brand, you know, when you're talking about like apparel or something, like you kind of, that's kind of like your lifestyle, or you're kind of like,
yeah,
you know, so like same thing with beer. It's like, if you're going to be at a party and you're going to roll up with a certain kind of beer, you roll in with that being like, it's kind of representing who you are as like a craft
brand.
Drinker.
It's super important. Yeah. And we're incredibly lucky that we have that on our side as an industry. We have brand on our side. Whereas wine doesn't. Wine just, maybe they will one day, but you know, you're hard pressed to think of five, you know, legit wine brands out there that aren't just big volume, kind of low shelf, bottom of the shelf brands, you know? So
gotcha.
Spirits definitely has that on their side. That's all they have on their side. Well, I shouldn't say all they have, but they have that in spades.
So thinking of like kind of jumping back to like, if you were a smaller to like medium sized brewery, like, I mean, I'm kind of curious, like how you consider like balancing having your more traditional kind of like core beers, like your more traditionally like quote unquote craft beer of like your Voodoo Ranger IPA series, say, right? Which has a very distinct look, you know, in regarding to its like branding, its packaging, versus balancing that with like how you're promoting and like having your like your Belgian collection or like your Wood Cellar Reserve or whatever, like fitting in. I mean, obviously they're going to be at different places in the store most likely, but say like if someone was to come into your like brewery or whatever to like try stuff, like how, I mean, I'm just kind of curious, like how would you consider balancing, or how do you balance that?
So if I were running, or if I were running a different brewery, like a smaller brewery, or like, are you saying like to put myself in the shoes of somebody else in that scenario?
Well, like, I mean, I guess so. I mean, obviously you guys are like, you know, I mean, or just how do you do that right now? If you were like a smaller to medium sized brewery, how would you maybe approach it?
Yeah. I think the one of the bigger things you'd need to keep in mind would be understanding what you're trying to grow. Like, are you, like right now, a lot of the industry is focused on building their brewery name. They're not focused on their quote, you know, purchase brands as something that they're growing. So what I mean by that is it's most breweries in craft are led by Stone. They're led by Dogfish, or they're led by their brewery name, and in that specific beer, you know, maybe it's their flagship or something like that. Like, they're not so focused on growing one specific brand underneath that brewery name.
Yeah.
So I guess my advice in that would be to really take a deep look at, like, are you, what's more important? Is growing the equity of your ambassador brand, or is it growing the equity of these like purchase brands, the actual beer that you're going to get on the shelf? And that's where you got to like really dig deep on what message you want to send, because when shelves are crowded, and they're going to be crowded for quite a bit longer, and when they're not crowded, it's not like that space is coming right back to beer. You know, you gotta know that you're going to get like one, two, maybe three SKUs on the shelf. So what do you want to start putting your weight behind, you know? And that's something that we've had to take a really hard look at over the past 3 years, really, is like New Belgium itself has a lot of equity in it. There's a ton of equity. Fat Tire has a ton of equity. For the longest time, we hardly even mentioned New Belgium on the Fat Tire six pack. It was just in this tiny little circle above the brand. So we became the Fat Tire Brewery, you know, and that's
right.
That can be a good thing. That can be a negative. It depends on what you want to do. You know, like, do you need to grow that New Belgium equity or not? And so I think it was 2014, maybe 2015, we did a rebrand and we expanded New Belgium onto our six packs because people just weren't aware of us, you know, and we had that through research. So we're like, okay, we need to expand New Belgium. There's a lot of equity. There's credibility there. It gives us a seat at the table because it's usually tied to our specialty brands, you know? So that's why especially portfolio is so tied to the New Belgium brand is, you know, we need to continue reminding people that we're making these badass beers. But then we're very intentional about the realities of how many people out there don't know New Belgium, don't care to know New Belgium. You know, they just want an IPA and they're grabbing this cool looking one on the shelf. And it connects with them for whatever reason, you know. So it's really hard to give like a solid here's what I would do, but I would say you got to look at like what what you want to grow, you know. Because you're not going to grow everything.
The attention from consumers are just going to be, you know, unless they're coming to your brewery all the time. But if you're talking about like on a retail, that's totally different. You know, you're going to be very.
That's probably a good way to look at it. Like, are you going retail with this? Or are you going to stay brewery only or self-distributed? You know, like those are two very, very different business models. And I can't stress that enough. Like there are so many conversations I have with our own internal, you know, coworkers that. Or like, man, why can't we do this? Why can't we do this? Why, whatever. It's like, well, because they are a brewery only place. Like they're focused on growing their brewery. They're tap room, you know. We have 350 distributors out there that are depending on us, and we're depending on them too. So,
yeah. Well, I think it's interesting you touched on the idea of like the position, like the size and kind of recognition of New Belgium on your packaging with like you're like known as like the Fat Tire brand I just recently put out an episode with my good friend Jordan, who did this really great rebrand for a small brewery here in Portland called Old Town Brewing, and they were kind of suffering from the problem of being a bit too forward with like the individual beer brands and not the brewery brand itself. So kind of almost like you're saying, like people knew, like they would see the beer, but then they would not even remember it was from this brand called Old Town. So like they rebranded to make that a bit more forward so that like at least, you know, and I think like with this, if you're a smaller brewery and like, you know, unless you've built some solid branding, like you say, like on the shelves, like if the shelves get smaller or like, you know, if all your like beers you're putting out, like one-off releases or just like releases that aren't, you know, out for too long. If your brewery isn't recognized as a brand, like when that goes away, like no one's going to remember your brewery at all because you haven't branded your brewery. Like you've been pushing out these individual releases.
A lot of weight and or a lot of, might to build a, you know, quote purchase brand, you know, because it's damn near impossible. I shouldn't say it's damn near impossible, but you know, like if you're a small, if you're a small brewery and you have, and you want to have one breakout brand that's not brewery led within its architecture, within its design architecture, you're going to need some solid distribution first off and a decent amount of money to communicate that message to a chunk of people. Like usually your brewery story carries so much more credibility to it, you know? So that's why it's so much easier to or not easier. It's just, it makes more sense to lean on that, brand heritage story, or that your roots story or something like that. That's going to get you in the door a lot faster. But eventually you got to make that, you might want to make that conscious decision to have this like breakout brand, you know. That I don't know the details behind 805 with Firestone, but that's from afar, that's what it appears they did with that, you know. They obviously designed that thing to not look and feel like any of the other Firestone brands, but they get the distribution with it. They have some money to put behind it. It's resonating in a very, very good way with Californians and whatever their demo is for that. And that's a really good brand to point to as an example of what I'm talking about.
Exactly. Yeah, I feel like that's always the classic example, like for a brewery that's kind of branded its own, one that just took off.
There's plenty of others in like different categories. Yeah. You know, Boston Beer does that pretty often with Angry Orchard or Twisted Tea or, you know, Truly. Those are separate categories that they're releasing beers within, and completely not calling it Boston Beer, you know. But there's not many really in the craft space that are doing that. There's Voodoo with us and 805, really.
Gotcha. Yeah. So I think people might be aware, maybe not, of the, you have the Fooder Forest there at the brewery. I imagine you probably get customer tours of that whole thing, right? Yeah. So I'm kind of curious to see like, how does that, if at all, kind of like fit into educating your consumers about like your specialty brands, and like how have you seen that customers come out from that, like having a higher like perception of like the more like specialty brands, like when they come out, like if they weren't already consumers that like were into this like kind of higher specialty beers?
We honestly haven't really tracked like people that take the tour and, you know, if that has any impact on their purchasing habits, but it's obviously the highlight of the tour. Like you see the phones come out as soon as you walk into that room, you see like that's where the romance is. The rest of the brewery looks absolutely gorgeous. But things just kind of stop when you walk in there. Like that's when people really slow down and are looking around like, what is this place? Cause it's just unlike anything they've ever seen. We call it Liquid Center, our LC, workers down there, they do a killer job explaining the history of wood aged sour beer in the United States and our history with it, and the romance behind it. It's the closest thing to the wine world that we're gonna get on the beer side of things, you know. So it's just very romantic. You know, using French oak, and it's just damn near impossible to not have a good experience in there. Then when we give them the beer, you know, we always guide them through the tasting of that, because if they haven't had a sour beer before, it's obviously very unique. So after that, you know, we see our bottles here sell very, very well of our wood aged sour beers, you know. So we're giving them a format and a pack, like an overall bottle that really matches the aesthetics and the experience that they just had in the wood cellar, you know. So that was really important to the overall rebrand that we did on our specialty portfolio, was we wanted to really mimic that heightened high touch experience of going through the wood cellar. And it has to deliver, we have to deliver that at retail as well. So even if you haven't taken the tour, we want to convey that on the shelf and then on the menu within the on-premise too. So we came out with a new glass, and we, you know, designed a new stemware for the specialty portfolio and whatever down the line. But we definitely see it resonating with people, you know. Like the you know, quote, beer geek community has definitely come back around, and sort of their eyes have opened a little bit back towards New Belgium of like, oh, you guys are actually doing some really cool stuff over there, like whatever it might be, with our small batch releases or wood aged sour program. It's just given us a whole new platform to speak from, really, and just kind of reinvigorated that message. It's only been about a year. It'll be a year in June that we've had our updated wood cellar packaging in the market. So we've had to like collect a whole lot of data, but from like just the qualitative view of things, it's looking, it seems to be resonating with people, you know? But yeah, I don't have like quantitatively how it's doing.
Yeah, I mean, I ask because I think, like, you know, I hear a lot of times, like, the one of the great opportunities for a brewery to educate people about their brand and, like, their beer and kind of elevate that is, like, through these kind of, like, brewery tours.
Yeah.
You know, and, like, not that, like, a like smaller breweries are going to be able to create, like, a food or a forest, you know, like,
right.
You know, kind of a situation.
But it's investing in that experience.
Yeah. Like,
it's really critical. I mean, it's. One of the best examples out there is like, look at what Starbucks has been doing. You know, they put up these roastery locations all around the world, really, as just a high touch experience. Like that's they're investing big. Like their CEO actually stepped down as CEO just to take on this like specialty position or what it's their, their reserve line, just to manage that because they knew how important it was to communicate to that higher end coffee drinker that they were still, that they're relevant in that space, you know?
Yeah.
They noticed that people were starting to equate them with like McDonald's coffee or just kind of too generic, you know, like McDonald's had that test or that did that thing that came out saying like that their coffee was tastes just as good as Starbucks or something like
that.
Ouch. So they were starting to get pulled into that medium range of things. So in order to stay above that, they realize that they need to invest in their experience. So those roastery locations are in like really prime spots and it's full on high touch. Like it's visual, it's sensory, it's education, it's all of that, you know? So when you see somebody like that, do it, you know, you're like, okay, they did their research.
Right.
So again, it's not to say, don't take it literally. Like this is, you need to open up satellite locations.
Satellite
breweries, but it's that theory that you got to keep in mind. And again, I go to quite a few breweries and there's a lot of copy and paste mentality going on where it's an old warehouse and, you know, same sort of aesthetic. It's all open. You can see all the good stuff, all the bad stuff. You can, you know, for that I think was kind of, I don't know what you want to call it, but that was kind of cool for a while. But now I think I worry about the industry as a whole falling into that rut of, or falling into that, comfort zone of not delivering a high end experience. If you're going to ask them to pay high dollar for your stuff, you gotta, be kind of consistent with that.
Yeah, that absolutely makes sense. Yeah. And I mean, right. I think people, you know, really like to be able to connect, like, experience a brand, you know, as opposed to like, you know, like buying a brand. And so I think that's like giving them that experience. And obviously, like you mentioned, like the romantic aspect of it, which I think is a great way to explain it. Like you get into like a wood barrel room and there's something about it, you know, maybe it's just because, maybe it just reminds me of like the times I've toured like wineries or something, but it just, it's this feeling to it, you know? And so,
yeah, it's got a little more emotion to it.
Exactly. Totally. Yeah. Totally makes sense. Right.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Sorry.
Oh, no. Well, I mean, I think you just mentioned this and I think it's a good segue about the idea of the experience and, the high touch and, you know, asking for, you know, kind of higher price points for this quality liquid. But and when we last spoke, you had mentioned the idea of like the kind of like high low situation, so like kind of having like higher end products.
My whole theory.
Well, if you were going to go somewhere else, don't let me wedge this into the conversation. But but I think this is definitely interesting. And if you want to kind of maybe explain what you think about that, and then kind of we can discuss from there.
Yeah. So. This, I don't know. I think a lot about this and I still don't know where I've landed, but the concept of the high low is really interesting right now. And what I mean by that is this like really high end thing, delivered or experienced in a kind of lowbrow manner, or a lowbrow thing experienced in a high-end manner. I guess that's usually where that seems to be what's working right now in culture in general. So by that, I mean the 25 karat gold chicken wing. That was a thing for a hot minute. You know, it's able to get you earned media very quickly. It's able to get you, you know, on BuzzFeed or whatever it is. And that in a series of that window, like when you do that well, I think that's when brands can really, really start to resonate. But you can also, it can also be done in a very sticky one and done kind of manner.
Yeah. So, I was just going to say.
Yeah. Totally. And we're still, you're still seeing it with like gold flakes on pizza and, you know, things like that. I'm trying to think of some other examples, but that, I think that's what we see going on right now with like the can craze or whatever, however you want to refer to it. That's what's really tricky for me to navigate around is the increase in cans and what like that's that like third and fourth wave of craft is doing out there with like releasing, you know, double IPA, 4-pack 16-ounce cans or single serve 16-ounce cans. It's this badass liquid in sort of a lowbrow package, you know, and I think that matches the irreverent attitude of craft nicely. And we have that in spades. We can do that, you know, we can do that all day long as well. But I don't know what the shelf life looks like on that, you know. To me, that's where I'm a little concerned with like how long that's actually gonna last. And are we still just speaking to the same small group of within craft? Like, is that really gonna expand the appearance of craft? Is that really romancing our story? Yes, it's getting you news, you know, because you used a cereal company on your brand, you know, you use like a, or it's you, you didn't like legally use cereal IP on your brand, but like,
right.
That, it, I yeah. think it actually well, chips away maybe negatively in the long term, but right now it's keeping people really interested and you know, it's keeping the buzz going, I guess, for craft.
Yeah, well, so I mean, my take on it, and I think I'm sure you'd probably agree, is that like the idea that the cans represents the craft, you know, just smaller. Now that like all the, you know, I'd say most all consumers know that like, you know, that these breweries are putting out these small batch releases in cans because like they can get a mobile canner to come to their place. You know, they can order these like stick on labels that don't wrap around the entire can. And I cracks me up how that became like thing, and like how like people also got smaller and smaller stickers that kind of like try to represent that it's like a small can.
Yeah. Well, also you got to think of the overall power of Instagram. I mean, this is craft beer is within the past 10 years, very much built on Instagram, you know? So you have these, highly visual packages that also typically have like a very funky looking liquid inside of them, you know, like it's my theory that that's why brewed IPA probably won't take off the way hazy has, because it's not Instagrammable. It doesn't look all that cool when you pour it, you know, whereas when you go to Untappd and look at the most tapped or most checked in beers out there, Guinness is almost always up there. Why is that? Because it's visually very appealing and people take their phones out when they pour that beer, you know? So it's like, that's the lens of like earned media that I try to think through, is like, that's where mega ripple effect takes place. And it's hard to, you know, quantify, but I think the can has helped usher that in. Also, the other really cool thing is cans don't communicate, hang on to this. You know, they don't cue you to put this in your fridge for the next 6 months.
Exactly. They're not
it
so
doesn't
precious.
Communicate, celebrate with this. It communicates, drink this now, you know? So that definitely
enjoy it.
Plays a huge advantage into the overall velocity of beers going into those cans. Now, it doesn't line up margin wise, it makes sense for us to do that with you know, 3 year wood aged sour beer. But that's what we're always exploring. Like, what does in that range, you know, like what can we do? What can we offer that might make more sense with that range? And to me, I think it's like, that's a package that's geared towards like one-off brands. It's not geared towards building a individual brand. You know, you're not going to build an individual brand on a 16 ounce can. You know, I think we saw that with Hetty Topper, saw it with maybe a few others, but they really don't seem to be as dominant as they once were. They're really great for like one-off brands.
Right. Yeah, exactly. And I'm thinking like New Belgium, like I, you know, you have these high-end, like, and kind of you've been mentioning like these kind of like wine stock labels and like these like nice bottles, the cork and cage, like it comes again with a romantic like perspective or like view and like feel, and you know, and so that completely makes sense. And like, obviously I don't think like you would just be like, oh, let's take these and throw them into cans and like, let's just replace that, you know, but right. And so, I mean, I guess if you're a smaller brewery, like you have the opportunity just to put out something new and like, and have that higher price point in like a can. I'd love to kind of like quickly talk about, when I heard you on the Full Pint podcast talking about connecting, your beers with like the food experiences, like, you know, maybe say like a restaurant or somewhere that, you know, serves food. Yeah. Because I think the idea of like the kind of wine and look and feel and like pairing beer with food, I think like goes right along with that. And I think that would be something that's going to last, you know, right? Like obviously like wine, you know, like that's so, yeah, I'd love to kind of hear your approach or thoughts on that.
Yeah, that's, so in general, I think, for a fact that like more neighborhood sports bars and taverns and, you know, the traditional drinking experience, like those places are closing at a higher rate. And they're not opening. That's for sure. So what's replacing those? And it's food driven drinking experiences. Like people, there's plenty of Nielsen data out there to point to, and I think everybody can just kind of look at their own habits and understand that people rarely just go out to drink anymore. That used to be a thing, you know, but it's not so much a thing anymore. It almost sounds weird to say, you know, that you're just going out drinking. It's almost always met with a food experience, like, or the food is what's driving that, at least that first occasion. So within that space, it's getting really difficult to compete with wine. And that's by nature of just like, for breweries our size, at least, our distributors typically haven't worked with those smaller accounts, because they don't take large volumes, and our distributors' business models are based on X number of cases going to per stop, you know? So first off, it's kind of hard to just get into some of these places. But luckily, because of that brand equity that we have in the New Belgium name, we have a seat at the table within a lot of these places. We have credibility on our side. We've been around for a long time. We're independently owned. We have all these like fun things, that we can point to, but it's not enough. Obviously, once you get in there, you have to, be able to romance your beer to that bartender or to that server, get it on the menu, so it's written correctly. And then the ritual comes in, and that's the ritual is what's so key there to have on your side. And wine has always had that, because it's the ritual of wine is almost always a cork. And it's almost always a stemware of some sort. And then there's the romance of what that wine is all about, that the server is usually up to date on. The wine world is excellent at communicating their product to those, that restaurant space. And I think that's why they're able to maintain the relevance and continue to grow their relevance so strongly. And that's what I think about pretty often, that we can't let off the gas on in the on-premise with us is that ritual of the experience, you know, and so much of that is texture is a really big thing, a really big piece of that. You know, when people see wine bottles on the shelf, they go to touch them, because they usually have some sort of gold foil stamping on them, or a lot of times they have embossing on those labels. The wine stock is pretty thick, the paperweight is pretty thick, they use all kinds of funky die cuts, you know, like they play around in that space aggressively, you know, and whereas totally. Beer traditionally hasn't, because we just don't have margin on our side, to be honest. Like that label, it's, you know, it's hard to pay more than 50 cents for a label or whatever it might be. But as you get into this more premium space, I think it's something to seriously consider putting your money towards finishing touches, and it's worth it, I think.
Yeah. I've had an idea for a while. I actually haven't got off the ground, but I started working on it. But I'm vegan.
Yeah.
And I just there's always like in the past, always see these beer events where it's food pairings, mm-hmm. you know. And I haven't seen one that's been vegan. I've attended a few that had options that worked, but they were not that exciting, you know. So I've always just like wanted to like get like pair up with some like badass breweries, like make great liquid, and then like pair up with some great like, you know, restaurant or chef, and just like do like a full on like a super elevated like pairing of like vegan food with like dank like super good beer.
I love that.
So I mean, I see opportunity. I feel like based on what you're saying too, breweries creating their own events like that are gonna like, if that's what you're going for, like the elevated mm-hmm. thing. Start creating your own events where you start bringing in this like super nice like high end food to like pair with your beers or something.
But giving it a theme is super key. Like beer and food pairing events used to work, you know, or just generic beer dinners used to work, but it's not enough anymore. So you got to have that theme to go along with it of like, yeah, we're doing a vegan beer and food pairing, or we're doing whatever it is, you know, Taco Tuesday, all tacos or all hot dogs with whatever.
Going for that high low thing.
Exactly.
Again.
I did.
Gold-plated hot dogs.
I did a hot dog beer pairing once when I was in Houston. That's pretty fun.
There you go.
But nice. Yeah, that I think that would totally resonate. I mean, it's not speaking to a broad audience is just kind of a losing strategy right now, you know, to go down. Everything is niche, and right now there's platforms out there to communicate to those niche people. You can, I mean, if you want to make Denver Broncos nacho loving people show up, like nacho, like Denver Broncos fans that love nachos that happen to love like Gamay wine, like you can probably target them in some way and get them to show up to your Nacho Gamay Denver Bronco event. Anyways, like it's definitely a fractioned world out there right now. And it's, when you can do anything you want, it makes it really hard to choose.
Oh man. There's already a face group for that already, I'm sure. Yeah, just tap into that.
Exactly.
Get an invite to that group.
Yeah,
and
but
set.
I think that's worth exploring, man. That's total turnkey thing.
Yeah. Totally. I think so. Yeah. Well, sweet. I think I covered a lot of great info. I think we're in a good spot to wrap it up here. My last question, I guess, would be like kind of what are the goals for the New Belgium like specialty brands, and like, you know, like what would the most ideal outcome look like? Say like, from where you're at in your position working with specialty brands and how they fit with like the New Belgium portfolio and brewery, like what is like the most ideal outcome? Like if 10 years, if everything was going like exactly how you'd hope it to be, like what would that look like?
North Star goal would be that, you know, we are able to sell as much wood-aged sour, like the same amount of wood-aged sour that we make, like if we're making that same amount every year for the next 10 years, that would be incredible. That wouldn't have to scale up or scale down, but that we could start increasing those single bottle sales again. That comes back into the craft world, you know. And I'm being very. I'm just trying to talk through this because I think that's where that ritual lies, and that would signify that the romance and the appeal of craft beer is still around. So I would say if our Cork and Cage beers growth is at, I'd say double the amount we make, about half draft, half Cork and Cage. I'd say if we were able to not make any more draft beer of sours and it was all cork and cage, that would be a massive, massive win for it. It would show that the industry is on the right path, yeah. And it'd be great for us. I mean, that's really where what the bread and butter is of our sour program. But also, I would say, speaking more broadly, if you could walk up to just about anybody in a nicer, hip restaurant in a major metro market and say, hey, who's a good Belgian style brewery out there? They would say New Belgium right away. Like that is for sure the big, like, that's the big prize for sure. Yeah. Yeah.
The goal. Yeah. Yeah. Cool. That makes sense. And I mean, of course, like, you know, the market's going to change. So you can't necessarily like, oh, in 10 years, like this is what we want, because it's like, well, you also have to do what the market is asking for.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a brutal reality of it all. And sometimes you got to be super cold about it. Like,
right.
If something's not doing well, it's gone. You know, like, yeah, that's it. You got to be really, really emotional or very passionate about what you're doing, but also the next day willing to completely cut it and move on, you know? And that's the, it's cold world of business.
Well, Andrew, man, I really appreciate you taking some time again. Hopefully we can run into each other at CBC. That'd be cool.
Yeah, dude, let's do it for sure.
Yeah. And if you're decently active on social, so like if people wanted to kind of connect with you, where should they go to find out more about you? And then if you want to point anyone to New Belgium too, like where should they go?
Yep. Just New Belgium is at New Belgium on everything. Then I'm at Andwoo, A-N-D-W-O-O. It's in reference to a stupid tattoo I got like 12 years ago.
Awesome. Of course.
15 years ago now. Something like that. Yeah.
Sweet.
Of course.
Yeah. Totally.
Yeah. That's it.
Right on. All right, man. Well, thanks a lot again, Andrew. Appreciate it. And we'll be in touch, dude, for sure.
For sure. Thanks.